And that's the kicky music. That means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Last week saw the loss of one of the most important human beings in the development of American prestige television. James Gandolfini passed away much, much too young. We'll talk about Tony Soprano and other indelible roles that can define entire careers, whether for good or for bad. Then we'll turn to a ritual some of you may be delving into this summer, the wedding. We'll talk about music and dancing and other cultural detritus encountered on these big days. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and assorted ephemera for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I am happy to see all of you, as always, here in Scenic Studio 44.
Studio 44.
Scenic, historic, in the sense that we are the only pop culture podcast to ever regularly broadcast from this studio.
Well, I believe this is a big anniversary for us. I believe this is like the 7th or 8th podcast we've recorded here.
Yeah. So it's our 7th anniversary.
It's our 7th or 8th anniversary.
Well, so I was actually called upon in the evening that James Gandolfini died to suddenly do emergency Gandolfini duty. And one of the things that
Which is to say, talk about him.
Exactly. One of the things that they asked me to do during my conversation with Robert Siegel was talk a little bit about the significance of the character of Tony Soprano. And what I had said at the time is, you know, to the degree that The Sopranos was really one of the major important moving forces in prestige television, Tony Soprano was really the genesis of these male antiheroes, which have really formed the backbone of shows like Breaking Bad and The Shield and Mad Men and bunches of other pieces of television. So, Trey, thoughts? Gandolfini thoughts?
Well, it's true. He brought a presence and a commitment to this character that kind of set a high water mark for a kind of character that had not been seen a great deal on television. That character exists in a whole bunch of other genres, in the movies, certainly, in the theater, God knows. But you're right, especially if you're talking about series television. There's just not been a whole lot before that.
Yeah.
Well, I think that one of the interesting things, and we're going to get into the topic of typecasting on this episode, that you have a lot of actors who are typecast because of the demographic they represent, the type they represent. You know, and you have your sort of your Vincent Pastores, your Danny Trejos, who get cast sort of in the same sort of role again and again and again, but they're not generally hugely meaty, thoughtful roles.
Right.
James Gandolfini got to play what in many instances would be a fairly simple type, you know, Fat Tony on The Simpsons, you know, just this very broad mobster character, and gave it these incredible layers of depth and breadth and thought. And I think the value of that performance really can't be overstated.
Yeah.
Yeah. When he wanted to stretch as an actor, given his physicality and given his presence, there wasn't a lot of places for him to go. He played a mobster in The Mexican, a gay mobster, not a mobster. He played a working-class Jersey guy in a very interesting film called Romance and Cigarettes from 2005, written and directed by John Turturro. It's a musical. He sings and dances, but his mannerisms and his voice are very Tony Soprano. So the first thing he does, one of the first things he does in that movie, is he lip-syncs along to an Engelbert Humperdinck tune, which you would never see Tony Soprano do. And, of course, in The Loop, he's a tough guy. He plays a general.
He went a little bit sometimes in the direction of lawman or government man rather than mobster.
It's a different kind of toughness.
Right.
It's a more intelligent toughness. But a lot of people have been praising his voice work in Where the Wild Things Are, where it's a very, all of a sudden, because we so associate this guy with his body and his type, just to hear his, now I haven't seen Where the Wild Things Are. Have any of you guys seen the Spike Jonze film?
I'm afraid I haven't.
Well, we'll just have to take the word of everybody I've read today who said how wonderful it is.
Yeah. It's interesting because when I was thinking about him, I was thinking about something that my pal Sarah Bunting had written about the difference between actors who have range in the sense that they can play lots of different mm-hmm. kinds of characters, and actors who have range in the sense that it may be a narrow scope, but within that scope, they bring tremendous depth.
Boy,
and and it's sort of an X-axis versus Y-axis thing. And she, I was going back and I asked her, hey, you know, remind me where that is because I want to go back and look at that piece again. She sends me the link and I go back and who do you think she was talking about? She was talking about Gandolfini
right.
because she was making the exact point that you see him in a certain type of role, but that within that role, he brings more levels to it than its range within a type. Mm-hmm. And he does more interesting mobsters and more interesting tough guys than anybody else, even if it looks like a narrow range.
I think that's true, too. Of all the parts that brought him notoriety, brought him a lot of attention, but sort of is probably the furthest from Tony Soprano, in the play God of Carnage
right.
on Broadway.
Right.
He plays a wholesaler, but it's still a family guy, and he's probably the least sophisticated of the characters on stage, but he's...
He's still an uptown guy.
He's still an
Those
uptown
all
guy,
uptown
right?
People.
This is a comedy of manners
right.
among the privileged class.
Right.
So that, I think, probably was the thing that... Of course, most people didn't get a chance to see it because it was in a Broadway theater, but of the roles that brought him attention after he was famous, that's probably the furthest he got from Tony Soprano, to the point where he told people that one night after he was having dinner after the performance and somebody walked up to him at the table and addressed him by his own name instead of saying, "Hey, Tony."
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And he told the director of that show that was the first time anybody had done that since the end of The Sopranos.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to talk a little bit about other people who may or may not be similarly situated, right? I think one of the most obvious parallels, I had this question about John Hamm, because although in comedy, I think he's demonstrated in Bridesmaids and on SNL, a bunch of other things, and on 30 Rock, an ability in comedy. But I question whether in drama, how hard it's going to be for him to get away from that kind of slick Don Drapery sort of male sex bomb.
See, I've been looking at what you're doing, and I think you're in desperate need of change.
And you're just the guy to do it.
I am.
But then there's a question of whether typecasting comes from who you are or whether it comes from the association that people make with you.
Right.
I was going to say, a lot of that might depend on audience size.
I
certainly don't remember what the numbers were for The Sopranos, but
sure.
Mad Men reaches, what, 2.7, 3 million people in a good week?
Yeah, and The Sopranos had a cultural penetration probably greater than Mad Men.
I feel like
Mad Men is a little bit more of a niche show. To me, the factors that jumped out in terms of why an actor is typecast are iconic roles, demographic type, limited range.
Yeah.
And, you know, with John Hamm, it may be an iconic role, but it also probably is body type, facial features. That is a big, good-looking lunk. Potentially ugly him up the way, like, Charlize Theron gets uglied up for Monster.
It's hard to ugly people up successfully. It really is. I mean, I don't say that entirely. Like, I mean, there are people who are so classically attractive.
Right. I have this problem. I go through an uglification process every morning that is painstaking in its scope.
I would guess, though, that John Hamm might be one of those people who could successfully hide behind costume and makeup. Some of those scenes where he's younger Don Draper, like when he was the auto salesman, I think.
Charlie, this car is 2 years old with only 25,000 miles on it. It's what you want.
I remember him looking much schlubbier.
Yeah. And I'm just picturing John Hamm, and then you just put some nerd glasses on him.
Right.
All of a sudden, he's a
Poindexter.
This is John Hamm schlub.
But looking at these similarly meaty roles and the actors who embody them, look at Bryan Cranston.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've talked about this when we talked about Breaking Bad, but here's a guy everybody knew as Malcolm's dad.
Oh, hell, that is the third bug I've seen today. You have got to call the exterminator.
What? And miss out on watching you hunt? You're like a sexy bug-killing panther.
Who is now Walter White. And, can he get away from playing Walter White?
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing is, on Mad Men, I don't think they use a lot of Hamm's comedy. I mean, you know, now and then there's a little wink to sort of a light moment, certainly, between him and another character. But on Breaking Bad, they explicitly use more, I think, of Cranston's comedy chops. Hmm. Walter White runs funny.
I guess what I would want to say is... to look on the bright side.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite things about that show is that Walter White runs funny. They've always kept a piece of the fact that that guy is a dad. That guy is like a suburban dad, part of him. And he's never stopped having kind of the goofy physical presence of a dad.
Well, you want to talk about iconic roles. To pick up on your point, Stephen, iconic roles. I mean, I don't think I've talked enough about Superman on podcasts.
No, probably not.
Let me just bring that back.
Yeah.
But every person who's ever donned the monkey suit has complained about typecasting for that role.
Sure,
for two reasons.
Mm-hmm.
A, it's a very weird thing to wear, and it kind of sears itself into your brain. But also, they tend to pick unknowns. So this is the, our first exposure to that. So Kirk Allen, who did it in the serials, actually was in later years was quite bitter about taking the role. George Reeves, of course, took his own life, wasn't really sold on the role himself. Christopher Reeve pivoted away from Superman as fast as he could to take roles in Monsignor and Somewhere in Time and Death Trap just to get out of the suit as in the public eye. Brandon Routh, of course, did a great thing in Scott Pilgrim. Had a really nice brief turn up there. So Henry Cavill, you could argue that this isn't going to happen for him. A, because he fills out the suit really good. And B, because he was actually in The Tudors. He was kind of sort of known in some circles. The name I left out for a reason, which is Tom Welling.
Left out Dean Cain.
Oh, I was going to ask you about Dean Cain, actually, because you're right.
His star has just continued to
Dean Cain.
If we're talking about Lifetime movies and hosting Ripley's Believe It or Not, I mean, but you know better what he's done since. What has he done since?
Not a whole lot.
I mean, not a whole tremendous lot. He is sort of in the Hallmark movie rotation at this point. He was in Operation Cupcake.
Sure he was.
Very wonderful. Great photos. But I don't know. I mean, I think that he was another one where it is a very difficult role to once you are that guy. Partly just because there's so much when they cast that guy. It's almost like Harry Potter. There's so much like who will get the role, and then it becomes boom, and then it's you. It's like it was like Katniss Everdeen.
But
I think she was very lucky that she was already known for other things and doing other things. If she had been an unknown, she did just those three movies, and then she tried to go on, I think she could have had some of the same problems.
Well, and you wind up look at Mark Hamill.
Right.
Right.
And yet Harrison Ford managed to,
So Tom Welling, real briefly, he might avoid this because he never wore the suit. Even at the very end of the, he played the part for 10 years.
So you think it's the suit itself?
I do think it's a combination of being a newcomer and the suit. However, we've seen Tom Welling in other roles in like Father of the Bride, and there's not a great indication that he's got a range.
Not a lot of range.
He's got to keep doing things. But I mean, if anybody's going to avoid the trap, it's either Cavill or Welling.
It is interesting that intersection of talent, range, chops, I guess, to put it another way, and signifiers, the outward signifiers of character. If I were to describe to you an actor who has played everyone from Othello to Macbeth to Didi in Waiting for Godot, in plays by writers from Ibsen to Arthur Miller, played characters from Scrooge to the pig in Animal Farm.
Michael Cera.
But Tony
Danza. Except for one remaining franchise gig, this actor cannot get arrested anymore in Hollywood. Who am I talking about?
Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart.
There you go.
Interesting.
You're saying that other than in X-Men, I think Patrick Stewart still pops up.
Yeah. Oh, sure, he's done plenty of things, but he pops up in things on stage. He plays Lear.
And I think British television.
I
think he still does.
And he does voice work. Family Guy and American Dad
I'm
and that
sure
sort of thing.
I don't get the sense that
sure
Patrick Stewart
is.
I'm not saying his career is dead, and I'm not sure. I'm not saying he's sad.
He can't get arrested in Hollywood. That's a certain measure.
Aside from playing the gay decorator in Jeffrey, what film can you think of that he's been in that's not X-Men or a Star Trek movie?
But those are two gigantic franchises.
I said, aside from his one remaining franchise game.
But here's a question, because Glenn brought up Superman, as he so often does. I mean, isn't that sort of any, obviously not any, because Robert Downey Jr. dons a big metal suit, but there are certain, I mean, how many, you know, a silly costume in general, like a very, very successful movie with a silly costume. I mean, there were some of that issue happened with Batman to a point, right? I mean,
well, and they kept changing out Batmans, like
that you had your Val Kilmer and your Michael Keaton and your George Clooney. So you know, it could.
That guy's career went nowhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's
but
a
people
great
still
point.
Laugh about George Clooney in the nipple suit
and the nipple suit. Yeah,
I think he got out of it. You'll notice he did the nipple suit once, and then it was like. All right, that was enough for me.
Well, speaking of getting out of it, like, you take an actor like Hugh Grant, who is now
I wanted to talk about Hugh Grant. I was going to do a whole James Gandolfini-Hugh Grant comparison.
Really? Maybe you should do that.
I'm
going to sit back and listen.
We're talking about the thing with the very narrow range, but many, many, many different roles.
Right. He plays the floppy-haired, self-deprecating, awkward, posh Brit. That's an important point. You'll never see Hugh Grant playing, "Oi, governor!" I mean, you will
except in Cloud Atlas.
Yeah. Cloud Atlas.
No, but he made actually a major turn. Uh-huh. Hugh Grant may look like he has a narrow range, but he made a big turn. He made a turn from sort of likable, shy, stammering fops to jerk face fops, which was
Bridget
the smartest, best thing he ever did, was play into the fact that there is a slightly douchey quality to him. And instead of acting like, all the time.
Right.
And he's done some lovely movies like that. Other people like Four Weddings. I greatly prefer Notting Hill, if you're going to talk about that kind of movie. But he's so funny in Bridget Jones. He's really funny and good and charming and sexy in Bridget Jones in About a Boy.
About a Boy,
I think is his best movie.
But predating those turns, I mean, he's always been the thing that follows through his entire career is a remarkable command of his gifts, because way back in 1988, he was one of the leads in a weird little film called Lair of the White Worm, a Ken Russell film, which is a cult film, and it's deeply weird. And he plays Lord James Denton, who is a posh, upper crusty guy. He plays him with an unlikability that's right on the surface. So he's playing the dark side of his charming rogue. He's playing the upper-class Brit as a jerk.
Yeah.
But he's ostensibly the hero. That's the really interesting thing about this take on the character. He plays it with a smirk. He plays it with this cloud of entitlement around him. And yet, he's the guy who saves the girl and defeats the White Worm.
Yeah. One of the kinds of people that I worry about a little bit in terms of where they're going to go from where they are is the people from Downton Abbey in the U.S. Now, in Britain, a lot of these people are already very established, have done all kinds of different stuff. But if you're talking about American film, you know, Dan Stevens left that show, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Stevens has left that show, wants to go do a bunch of other stuff, undoubtedly. He plays Cousin Matthew, for those who don't know. I have a really hard time believing that Americans are ready to embrace him as something sort of completely else, something without any of his Cousin Matthew-ness.
Dan Stevens in Fast and the Furious 7.
I don't know. I
don't see that happening.
I think you'd give that guy a different accent and a different haircut and keep him as far as possible away from tweed or white tie. And he's all right. He's just bland looking
enough.
He's just bland looking enough that he can do stuff.
Trey.
I mean, he's very handsome, but it's a very generic kind of handsome.
Trey. You know nothing.
John
okay.
No.
One more category, because I mentioned iconic roles, demographic type, limited range. Also, when the actor, him or herself, has become a stereotype.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking of Christopher Walken.
Sure.
Right.
Like, what does Christopher Walken do to bust out of his Christopher Walken-iness? What is Woody Allen to do?
He does Seven Psychopaths, right?
Well, or...
talk about steering into the skid.
I actually saw Christopher Walken in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival in a movie I didn't otherwise care for that much, in which he played an aging cello player. And I had to sit here for a minute and think, that was Christopher Walken and not John Voight, right? Because I always do that. But it was Christopher Walken. And he was a cellist in a quartet, it's called A Late Quartet. Also as Catherine Keener and Philip Seymour Hoffman. And he plays the cellist for this quartet, and he's getting older, and he's actually, I believe it's Parkinson's he's developing. Mm-hmm. And so he has to sort of step back from this group a little bit. It's about kind of the fracturing of the group. It's very un-Christopher Walken-y. It's very restrained. It's very simple. He's playing a very ordinary dude. And that was the thing I really liked about it. Other parts of that movie have a lot of kind of messy stuff about them. Bob Mondello did not like it at all. But I liked that part of it. But you're absolutely right that it's tough to find in something.
Well, there's several lists online of the most typecast actors.
Oh, yeah?
And he is in every one of them. Yeah. Also, people like, let's do a lightning round real quick.
Michael Cera.
Michael Cera, who is actually in This Is the End. He's very, very funny.
And he's intentionally playing against that.
He's doing the Neil Patrick Harris.
Jennifer Aniston.
Right, Jennifer Aniston's on the list. Christopher Lee, which, of course, but you can't have Christopher Lee and not have Peter Cushing on this list.
True.
Steve Buscemi. Mm-hmm. Now, again, early on in his career, Parting Glances, he played a very young man.
He does a lot within that.
It's a huge
Boardwalk Empire is pretty different from Fargo in
That's
some
true.
Ways. It depends on how you want to think about it.
Helena Bonham Carter, mm-hmm. of course,
now.
She's kind of now. But
no.
before she used to,
right.
like, in Howard's End and Room of the View or whatever.
Develops.
She was,
it yeah. develops. People decay into typecasting, I think, sometimes.
The one that's inarguable is Peter Lorre. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
He didn't exactly yeah. bring a lot of
yeah.
range.
There's a
I guess on the decaying into typecasting front, you've got to talk about Maggie Smith, right, since we've
sure.
mentioned Downton Abbey.
Again, I think now.
And Morgan Freeman.
She only
now.
Gets
Morgan
cast as certain
Morgan
kinds
Freeman, yeah.
of characters now, and I think it's possibly because she doesn't have to work very hard, and she's like, sure, if you're willing to pay me, I'll do that. But, you know, there was a day when she was Miss Jean Brodie and, you mm-hmm. know, this very complicated sort of character and not at all the waspish.
Sure.
I think a lot of characters, I think a lot of actors as they age, people are not. I mean,
you start
kind
getting
of
typecast as an old person.
Well, no,
Go
but
figure.
It's a slightly different question, but a variation on this is sort of as people age and opinions of them and feelings about them harden a little bit, people stop using all of the pieces of their abilities
right.
because
mm-hmm.
it becomes easier to just have Morgan Freeman always be the wise, old, godlike guy
yeah.
than it is to actually do something else with him. But, you know, I do want to say, people tend to assume that typecasting is sort of all bad.
Right.
Or the people who are typecast are sort of not doing anything. I'm sort of serious when I raise a guy like Tony Danza and I say, if that guy is in the right kind of role,
sure.
he's very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
There's
Absolutely.
A reason why people like him and people like George Wendt and, you know,
right.
like guys like that get work partly because they're very good at the thing that they do. And I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with that. We talked a while ago about, in the context, actually, of Kouvenjine Wallace, we talked a little bit about the balance between what is skill and what is you.
Right.
And for some of these people, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not fun to watch when yep. a lot of it is you, when
right,
a lot
right.
of it is coming from your presence and your persona.
Well, and I was wondering sort of about the future of a Seth Rogen.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who generally plays not only a certain type, but a type that is associated with them as a person. Like
right.
Seth Rogen, who's very good, but always seems to be playing Seth Rogen.
Right. He may be able to do other things, yeah. but he hasn't really yet.
Yeah, but in something like 50-50, he's turned down the volume mm-hmm.
Will Ferrell is in this category
exactly.
somewhat, too.
Yeah, exactly. And Will Ferrell has certainly tried other things. The one he made with Emma Thompson, where she's the writer and...
Stranger than fiction,
yeah. you know, he's certainly tried some other things, but for the most part, yeah, Will Ferrell is always Will Ferrell. Seth Rogen's always Seth Rogen.
I think the question with your Seth Rogens is how long can he keep doing that? Because it's not just that guy. It's that guy at that age, right?
Mm.
There's a particular behavior that's set that goes with being that age, and it'll be curious to see him find a new
Which
place
to
operate.
Which is to say, like, 38 going on 15?
Well,
yeah.
And eventually you do find... You know, people find other things. Like, people would have been surprised at one point that Eddie Murphy was
sure.
going to turn into Eddie Murphy, or
right.
Steve Martin was going to turn into Steve Martin,
right.
or even Bill Murray, who, you know, was this,
Talk about
did
your,
nothing but
yeah.
wise asses when he was
yeah.
young. As he got older, he became sort of
now he does soulful wide
well,
wise
more
asses,
of a character
yeah.
actor, mm-hmm. more, you know, less of a comedic goofball. Doing so, I mean, he just played FDR, for God's sake.
Right.
The movie's not very good, but, you know, he did it.
He pulled it off.
So,
The name that was on the top of one of these typecast lists was John Wayne, which I would argue, that's not typecasting, that's just a type. I mean, John mm-hmm. Wayne was not
yeah.
like, oh, I couldn't get any work
yeah.
because people just think of me as this guy. He got lots of work because people thought of him as that guy.
Yeah.
Three people who never broke out of their niche in Hollywood, Charles Nelson Reilly, Paul Lynn, Roddy McDowall. They never got their Stanley Kowalski, you know?
Yeah.
They never really...
Stella!
Ho-ho! They never broke out of that.
Charles Nelson Reilly is Stanley Kowalski.
You just did that so you could do the Charles
Well,
Nelson
also this,
Reilly.
Liberace. Liberace played on the two most highly rated episodes of the Batman television show from 1966. He played a piano player, go figure, and his evil gangster twin, Harry. And so the piano player was, you know, sort of a feat trying to marry Aunt Harriet, and the evil gangster was like, yeah, she? Like, it was really... like, he was actually playing with his persona in a really funny way. And his three sidekicks, by the way, were female sidekicks. What were their names? Guess. Doe. Ray and Mimi. I love that show. It's the best show ever.
That's genius. That is absolutely genius. Well, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and let us know, you know, what you think about typecasting. And, of course, tell us what The Sopranos and James Gandolfini meant to you. There's been a lot of that conversation over the last week, but you can't have too much. is my feeling. Speaking of you can't have too much, summer is wedding season. Now,
do we know why that is?
Well, here's the thing. It's
people,
well,
people are on vacation. There are more vacations.
It's nicer to have your wedding outside if it's warm.
I was going to say, because it's summer and someone is in a large, heavy white dress and the guys are usually in black.
In black. And, you know, heavy black.
It just seems like a terrible idea.
I don't know.
You're talking about weddings in general?
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I think that weddings, the thing I notice now is that now that I'm over 40, I have finally passed the point where I constantly have to think about whose wedding is next.
Right.
And I believe that the next wedding among my friends is actually going to be the people who can now have their wedding I've already been to become legal.
Yeah. I was going to say, I'm past 40 and all of a sudden I'm going to
a ton of weddings.
I'm in the deluge.
I bet that's exactly
right.
You
were deeply opposed to gay marriage because it meant you were going to have to buy a lot
darn presents.
I bet that's exactly right. But we wanted to talk a little bit about wedding music, partly because, Stephen, why don't you explain the piece that you had this past week?
Yeah, I wrote an advice column for the All Songs Considered blog. It's a series. It's called The Good Listener. And the person who wrote in said, basically, my wedding DJ is only allowing me to choose 10 songs.
That's
to play. Yes, so we'll get to that in a second. Now, I have decided the only two that I'm sure of are Van Morrison's Into the Mystic.
Just like way back in the days of old. How magnificently we will fold into the mystic.
And Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, Can't Take My Eyes Off.
You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you.
The others just change by the minute. I can't decide. And so, you know, you kind of take that in a couple of different directions. One is what sort of twisted monster says you can only pick 10 songs to be played at your wedding? Like, whose wedding is this anyway?
That is BS.
Right, this guy is saying, I don't care how large the check you're writing me is, I must have room for my creative expression.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because a lot in the comments, a bunch of interesting discussions broke out, which doesn't always happen in comments. But you had a lot of wedding DJs who were like, oh, really? You know?
Well, the thing about it is, in the age of the playlist, you would think it would be easier than ever for the DJ ahead of time to be like, even if you want 100 songs, as long as you tell him ahead of time what they are, all he has to do is turn the iPod on
right.
and go
what
have
skin
a
is it off
drink.
Your ass? And you know, wedding DJs are already competing with the iPod.
Right. You better be a good wedding DJ and do some colorful announcing.
And one thing that's fun in the comments to this piece is you have a bunch of wedding DJs talking about the actual craft of being a good wedding DJ. Because I have been to weddings
awesome.
With terrible wedding DJs, and I've been to weddings with great DJs.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. Then you also have the issue of... To me, now several people wrote in to dispute one of my points in the column I wrote is, who dances to Into the Mystic? Is Into the Mystic a danceable song?
Hi, people.
It's kind of a swaying and admiration song and not necessarily a floor filler.
Yeah.
And so I kind of speculated that maybe the DJ was a little tired of, I want to hear my favorite songs that will establish me as the sort of cool person who picks Into the Mystic as a wedding song.
But here's the thing, though. You don't have control in many cases. You don't have a lot of control over the music in the ceremony. When I was in college, one of my very dear pals was the organist in a large Catholic church near Oberlin. And he would go and do weddings, and sometimes I would go with him and sit up in the choir loft while he played the organ at weddings. And the priest had a lot of say in terms of, you really could only have sacred music. There was a whole thing about, no, you cannot have a whole new world. In the ceremony, you could have it while people were filing in. You could have it, I think, when people were filing out. But you could not have it within the ceremony. It couldn't be your processional because it couldn't be part of the ceremony because it wasn't sacred. So to me, by the time you get to the reception, you got to be in charge because – and the people I like are the ones – I mean, because I did go to Oberlin, I had a gazillion musician friends.
Right.
And the best wedding music I ever was at was this same couple that I think is perhaps going to be legal soon. my pals, Jason and Matt, who they got married in Rochester, New York. They had the Rochester Gay Men's Chorus was there. They had a, I think, a horn ensemble nice. There. And then at
the Canadian Brass.
At the reception, there was either a DJ or a band. And here's the thing. Nobody will remember whether your wedding had a DJ or a band. So don't hire a band. I'm just saying.
Band leaders across the country.
I was going to say.
Just wailed.
It's a mean thing to say. No, I don't mean that. What I mean is, if you're going to hire a band, make sure you hire a great band.
Yeah, right.
Don't hire a generic band on the theory that a band is important instead of a DJ.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you hire a bad band, nobody will remember.
Yeah. Now, you talk about there's sort of your processional music, there's mm-hmm. your dance music,
right.
and there's your dinner music. And I right. said, I made the argument in the piece, like, consign Into the Mystic that is wonderful dinner music. Mm-hmm. Consign that to the dinner. Dances are for dancing, right? I mean,
you're not going to dance Into the Mystic?
No, it should be said at some point here, and I didn't say this in the column, that my goal at every wedding, with every wedding, is to be the last person the couple regretfully crosses off their invite list.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I'm not necessarily the best.
How do you
hear? Authority.
But then, how do you hear Love Shack?
Well, and here's where you say,
if you don't go to weddings, how do you get your RDA of Love Shack?
No, this is where I should say that the one required song in every reception should be Push It by Salt and Pepper.
Your baby
that's
got
gonna,
back.
That's going to offend grandma. The problem is.
Well, right. And you do the oldies in the beginning. I mean, you go
wait
to enough
for grandma to be
then,
bored.
Then
and
grandma
leave.
Leaves, and yes. then you bring out
Push It
and
yeah.
Baby Got Back.
Well, here's the thing, though. But I remember a few years ago you made a wedding mix. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For someone you knew.
Yes.
And the conversation we had at that time was that you were surprised that almost all of the love songs that you liked were incredibly depressing. And it was very. It was hard to actually find ones that were sort of light and pleasant.
That didn't have notes of anguish.
Yeah, exactly. Now,
and this was a mix. This was
third,
a mix.
Third song on Stephen's wedding mix is You Don't Bring Me Flowers.
You don't bring me flowers.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, send in the clowns.
I love weddings. And I'm not actually kidding. I love weddings. If you are going to troth plight and you want to invite people to be there, to witness it, to mm-hmm. participate in it before, you know, ecumenical, non-ecumenical. If you need an usher, give me a role. I ush very, very well. I can accompany.
Have you ushed?
I have ushed many times in many
nice.
Different venues.
Nice.
Because I'm good at that thing where 30 seconds I talk to your great aunt as we're walking the 30 feet and I fit her into an empty pew. I do that sort of old person Tetris that is part of every wedding. I am great at it. Invite me to your wedding. I will be honored and I will be humbled to be at your wedding. Don't invite me to the reception. Hate the reception. The reception is the worst. The reception
is. Don't want to go to the party?
Everything that is bad.
The party with the open bar and
talking to strangers. Of course, he doesn't want to go to the party.
It is small talk with scary new people. It is drunk second cousins, and it is the chicken dance.
And that's our show, everyone.
It's the worst. It's the absolute worst.
Well, no. But the absolute worst is, I kid you not, liturgical dance. I have been
wow.
in a wedding that involved liturgical dance during the ceremony. Oh. And I'm just going to leave that right there.
Wow.
It is. I understand the ritualistic aspect of it, though, because for my family, the only place that multiple generations get together, there's plenty of places where we get together and chew at each other over potato salad. You know, that's like, there's plenty of that. The only place we get together in celebration, in joy, in dance,
is
a wedding.
I was going to say, my sister's wedding is the only time I've ever danced with my father.
Really?
Which, wow. I don't have a burning desire to dance with my father. I don't want you all to think that that's a sad thing, but it's just not something we would do. Like, him or me. We're not dancing people.
Well,
but
okay.
I danced with my father at my sister's wedding, and it's a nice thing to have done once.
No, wait, Linda, your father was the principal at your high school, right?
Yes.
Not even at the prom?
No, my father was at my dances. It was middle school, not high school. My dad was at my dances, but mercifully stayed as far away from me as possible at dances.
Whereas Stephen, I suspect, has on vinyl, and he keeps it in a climate-controlled vault and polishes it from time to time, a pressing of Daddy's little girl that he's just saving up, right?
Yeah, no, but here's the funny story. I remember reading, and maybe I've told you guys this story before, but I remember reading a similar question where someone was asking for father-daughter dance songs.
Yeah, I did do a column about that.
It wasn't your column, but
I actually did one about father-daughter dance.
But this was one where it was kind of, you know, give me a song for father-daughter dance. And somebody had produced the list that their DJ gave them of possible father-daughter dances, and on the list was My Heart Belongs to Daddy. And I looked at it and I was like, that's a different kind of daddy.
Because my heart belongs to Daddy.
Doesn't mean what you think it means.
You haven't listened to that song at all because it's about a prostitute.
Yeah.
kind of.
So this thing
a
where,
nice kind of prostitute.
So this thing where families get together and dance and not about prostitutes, but they just get together and dance.
Dancing about prostitutes.
In my family, it was completely foreign, happened only at weddings. In my partner's family, a Cuban family, that was called Saturday. Literally every Saturday, they would go over to Abuela's house when the kids were small, and Abuela would get out the instruments, they'd play, and it was like, this is how you teach the kids merengue, this is how you, and the kids learn that as they get older, and it's all, and the songs, they don't reject the songs that their parents love, they embrace them in a way that my is just does not, and there is a skillful, unself-conscious, joyous dancing that I have no way into, but I remember going to Faust's cousin's wedding, and we were in the parking lot for the banquet hall, and something seized me. I got a cold sweat, and I turned to him, and I said,
I need to dance.
Are they going to do the conga? It's called preparation trick, man. So I asked him that question, because it's Gloria Estefan, patron saint of Miami, saint of Cubans in Miami, and he looked at me with a mixture of pity and disdain, because it was as if he had asked me if we were going to a Welsh wedding, my family's wedding, if we all came out with pickaxes and miners' helmets and things like that. I was like, no, we are not going to be doing the conga. But at lots and lots of other non-Cuban weddings, when you hear that, it just my blood runs cold. Here's the secret. You shove your hands under the table as soon as you hear that start up, because people come by your table, and if they see a hand anywhere, on top of anywhere, they will grab.
Oh, my God. I would love to see you pulled into a conga line against...
Has never happened.
Yeah, we're going to have to do that someday.
So the other thing that sort of came up in the column really briefly is the question of who is your wedding for?
Right.
And a very important thing to ask, because a lot of people in the comments to that piece were sort of, this is about the couple. No, your wedding is not about the couple. The wedding is about the guests.
Your marriage is about you. The wedding is for everybody
around you. Focus on you for the marriage, but you're throwing a party, not making them stand around and watch you listen to Van Morrison. That's what I'm saying.
If they put that on the invitation.
Watch us listen to Van Morrison.
Right, which I think necessarily rules out extended versions of things like the joint candle lighting and the combining of sand from two glasses
into
one.
Great other thing to not do.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the thing is, I have been to very traditional weddings that have been lovely. Jason and Matt had by far the most traditional wedding of all my friends, except for the fact that they're both dudes. Mm-hmm. And I have also been to, you know, an extremely tiny wedding in the Chapel at Yosemite, which is also an amazing place to get married, and that had many fewer trappings. It really does depend on the wedding. It depends on the people. I loved my sister's wedding, even though I remember so little of it, unfortunately, the exception of my dress.
I'm the same way about my own wedding.
I mean, I don't remember a lot of it, but I remember it very fondly. And that's what I always tell people about weddings in terms of who they're for. Just remember, most people are going to remember things about the people from the day and not things about your cake or your...
Well, and just basic wedding advice, skimp on flowers, don't skimp on photos. It's that same mentality. It's about a party. It's not about, come and I've assembled this playlist of amazing music. People want to dance. People want to spend time with their friends. Yep.
Well, you can come and find us on Facebook or at the blog, or you should look up Stephen's column, The Good Listener.
You should always read my writing.
Always read The Good Listener, and he will tell you all about weddings.
I just can't believe that we're getting out of this segment without anybody commenting on the fact that Linda used to go and spectate from the choir loft at weddings.
Yeah.
It's true.
Recreationally.
I did. Well, I was spending time with my pal.
There you go.
I would go with him. Anyway, that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I would love to report that it is my extensive culinary adventures. Uh-huh. They are limited so far to discovering that you can smear peanut butter and jelly on pancakes and create little pigs in a blanket, but the pig is peanut butter and jelly.
Okay.
So I'm like a pig that met a really bad end.
I'm behind on the cooking.
It's a start.
But
it takes a while.
But I'm getting there. That was a lovely discovery. If you can smear peanut butter and jelly on pancakes, I did not realize this. No, actually for me, it's something very, very simple, which is today being Monday, there was kind of, at the beginning of the day, there was looming dread that a bunch of big news was coming.
Mm-hmm.
Big Supreme Court cases, all sorts of just looming events. And the fact that the day, what ended up being the big story of the day, was Rusty the Red Panda is missing. And
that's
first,
capital Rusty.
First of all, yes, Linda decided that there was clearly going to be a movie about this called That's Capital Rusty, because Rusty was missing from the National Zoo in Washington D.C. And what I loved about it, first of all, it was a very contained story. Panda lost, panda found.
Panda fine.
Every panda fine.
Panda's doing fine.
Everybody's great. Look, yeah. A panda. I just loved that instead of these horrible things, not even always horrible, just big and important and
right.
Momentous.
These things of
and
import.
That no matter what happened, everybody was going to be pissed off.
Right.
Instead, it was a panda. Uh-huh.
The day was taken over by Rusty.
And who doesn't love, look, there's a panda in my backyard. You know, pictures of the panda on the loose.
Now that Stephen has said panda 47 times, right. Let's reiterate, it was a red panda, not one of the big black and white
things.
Waddling
around Adams Morgan. Not a big galumphing panda. It was kind of a fox-like.
Basically a raccoon.
Basically a big red raccoon. But like kind of a fox. You know, right. It was, but the idea of it.
It was a foxy panda.
To be fair, I took my 16-year-old niece and her two friends to the zoo the week before, like a week before. I saw Rusty the Red Panda. You could see in his eyes.
He was about to break out.
He was about
that
to snap.
Haunted look.
He had a little red panda Morgan Freeman next to him.
But this is what I'm talking about.
Get busy living.
This is what I'm talking about. This was the day. It was a panda. Oh, I just
the day
loved
full of panda
it.
Jokes.
And it was just one of those things, like, you find out a panda's missing, you immediately go to Twitter.
You know how that happens.
Yeah, you know, how as one
Every
does.
Every time you find out a panda's
as
missing,
one does.
You go to Twitter.
You just go to Twitter, and you just know, like, all your friends are making jokes. Nobody's mad.
You have, like, a right. missing panda protocol.
I do now.
I love that. I love that. Thank you, Stephen. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Pretty boobs.
I'm going to need a follow-up.
Come
Thank
on.
Thank you so much.
What's a reaction? The life and times of the glamorous international icon of stage, screen, and television, Belle Poitrine, which, if you have any French, translates to pretty bosoms, were musicalized in 1962 by none other than Neil Simon, his very first musical. It is called Little Me. It's based on the book by Patrick Dennis, also known as the author of Anti-Mame. And in the original, in 1962, Sid Caesar played all seven of the leading men. It is being revived as part of the Encore series at City Center in New York this coming February. Just been announced today. Christian Borle, who got terrific notices in Peter and the Starcatcher on Broadway, and I think everybody liked him, in Smash on NBC. So that is what's making me happy today, this relatively little-known musical, which offers a big star turn for a multi-talented person in the role of seven very different husbands of Belle Poitrine, each sort of representing one of the seven ages of man. Christian Borle in Little Me this coming February. Available, not Saxon Rule, available to everyone in New York or able to get to New York.
Lovely.
Next February.
Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
I had kind of a weird whistle-stop tour of every podcast I really like.
Yeah, you sure did.
And it was surreal to get to talk to the Slate Culture Gab Fest and Roman Mars on 99% Invisible and Ben Blacker on the Nerdist Writers Panel this week. It was surreal because I really admire all those podcasts. Good surreal. Melty stopwatches, not slicey eyeballs.
Right,
but,
sure.
But really good and wonderful and amazing.
And this is actually where we learned that for sure that Stephen Metcalf, host of Slate Culture Gab Fest, doesn't listen to this podcast. So we can say about him whatever
yes,
we like.
Yes, we strongly suspected he didn't listen before. So, but the thing that was making me happy is a discovery of a movie from 2008, which I never saw, but I should have. Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. Mm, yeah. Now, Hellboy, I love the Mike Mignola comic. I like BPRD, which is sort of the follow-up. It's heavily stylized, and really, it's action with a heart, and it's got a human center amid all the sort of mythical things. I like the first Hellboy. So I don't think there's a lot of people out there who, A, liked the first Hellboy, and B, didn't see Hellboy 2. But I'm one of those people because other things, you know, other things came up and, you know, there's always negotiation about like films and so many other things compete. But this movie, if you liked Hellboy, you're going to love Hellboy 2 because it's just that but bigger. And
this is the one with the giant plant as a villain, right?
There is a giant plant that pops up, yes. And but the amazing thing about it is it's Guillermo del Toro. And there are these giant action set pieces where you can follow along exactly what's happening because he locates the action in a way that's really smart. There's this giant robot fighting thing at the very end, which should just be noise, but it's he can tell a story with action in a way that certain other directors cannot. And it was just really, it's a lot of fun. It's a perfect Sunday afternoon movie, big heart, and a lot of fun. Hellboy 2, The Golden Army.
Hellboy 2. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. All right. Well, I have a couple of things this week. First, I want to mention my pal, friend of the show, Sarah Ventry, went on stage at a Washington event called Speakeasy.
Oh, yeah.
And told a story about the night she went to the closing show at CBGB's and how she got in despite not having a ticket and how she got herself, you know, through the door. And it's quite a story. And I was very impressed with the telling and with the story and with the fact that the audience gradually came around, which was lovely to see. And it ends on kind of this note of triumph. And it just thrilled me to the core. I refer to Sarah always as my mini-me, and which she sort of is. And I was very thrilled. And we will we'll put a link to the video on YouTube.
Not only can we put up a link to the video on YouTube, she wrote a blog post about that for the All Songs Considered blog. That is very, very fun.
It's a terrific story. So there's that. Number two, I realize that every time I talk about whatever they're doing on Code Switch, little hearts float around my head and everyone makes fun of me because I know I have little dancing hearts all around my head. But if you did not see the bro map that they did this past week, it's circulated enough. Many of you have seen it. But if you have not seen the bro map in which the Code Switch team came up with the different vectors of brohood, what it means to be a bro. There's a Venn diagram with Ryan Lochte in the middle.
It's not technically a Venn diagram.
I know. I was hoping no one would bring that up. It's technically a something else.
Yes.
But it is what normal people think of as a Venn diagram. Uh-huh. And it's brilliant and funny, and the writing that went along with it is also brilliant and funny. And it was genuinely, I read it and I just was falling out of my chair. It's so funny and smart and It is fantastic. So the bro map.
So this is just a survey of all the great people at NPR.
That's true.
Sarah Ventry, great. Code Switch people, great.
That's true. The third one is actually not from NPR. The third one is actually, I saw a documentary in Toronto last fall called How to Make Money Selling Drugs, which is starts off being sort of in a parody format, like an instructional infomercial about how to make money selling drugs. But gradually goes through really the economics of the drug trade and then becomes an examination of policy and prohibition as a philosophy and imprisonment, the treatment of drugs as a largely criminal issue rather than medical issue and all of that stuff and foreign policy and police procedure. And it's amazing how much stuff they fit in. And it has this fun, clever kind of slightly bent attitude. This is the one where Woody Harrelson is in it. And
I was going to say, your usual Hollywood suspects.
Woody Harrelson is in it, and they're not exactly sure what credential to officially attach to Woody Harrelson in a movie about drug policy.
Actor, activist.
And so under his name, it says Freedom Enthusiast, which is genuinely one of my favorite on-screen captions in the history of documentaries. So those three things, Sarah Ventry, The Bro Map, and How to Make Money Selling Drugs.
And we will resurface Linda's review from the Toronto Film Festival at npr.org/movies on Friday.
Absolutely. And that is our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn Weldon at G-H Weldon, WELDON. We want to especially thank Nick Fountain, who is sitting in as our producer this week.
Our Jess Gittner. Our Mike Katzeff.
Our Jess Gittner, our Mike Katzeff, our Nick Fountain, who you can follow on Twitter at, believe it or not, Nick Fountain. And you can follow Jess. She's not here now, but you can still follow her on Twitter, her adventures at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. And you can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katzeff at Mike Katzeff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thanks again to Nick. And we will see you all back here next week.